returned from Poconocket with Edward Winslow. Suddenly overcome by exhaustion, Pratt collapsed under the trunk of a fallen tree. "Mr. Hamden," he called out, "I am glad to see you alive." Hamden explained that Massasoit had told them of the plot against Plymouth and Wissagusset, and that Governor Bradford had recently convened a public meeting to discuss how the plantation should proceed. It was irritating in the extreme to know that they had been put into this mess not by anything they had done, but by the irresponsible actions of Weston's men. The one encouraging bit of news was that thanks to Winslow's efforts at Poconocket, Massasoit was once again on their side. There was little doubt what the sachem expected of them. They were to launch a preemptive strike against the Massachusetts and snuff out the conspiracy at its source. The fact remained, however, that thus far no Indians had even threatened them. If they were to initiate an attack, it would be based on hearsay, and they all knew from experience how misleading and convoluted the rumors could be. Then again, with a sachem as trustworthy and powerful as Massasoit telling them to act, what more justification did they need? Yes, they decided, their future safety depended on a swift and daring assault. Edward Winslow later claimed that it much grieved us to shed the blood of those whose good we ever intended. In truth, however, there were some pilgrims who felt no such misgivings. Miles Standish had been itching to settle a score with Wituamat ever since the Massachusetts warrior had snubbed him at Manomet. For the captain, the matter was personal rather than diplomatic, and he was going to make the most of it. Bradford, normally careful to restrain his combative military officer, appears to have given Standish free rein. It was agreed that the captain should make an example of that bloody and bold villain and bring back Wituamat's head to Plymouth, that he might be a warning and terror to all of that disposition. Standish put together a force that included Habermock and 7 Englishmen. Any more, and the Massachusetts might suspect what the English were about. They would sail for Wissagusset, pretending to be on a trading mission. Instead of launching a full-scale attack, they would, after secretly warning Weston's men, take the Indians in such traps as they lay for others. They were scheduled to leave the same day Pratt staggered out of the forest. Standish postponed their departure so that he could extract as much information as possible from the young man. The pilgrims found Pratt's story good encouragement to proceed in our intendments, and with the help of a fair wind, Standish and his men left the next day for Wissagusset. Before landing, they stopped at the Swan, anchored just offshore. The little vessel was deserted, but after Standish's men fired off a musket, the ship's master and several other men from Wissagusset walked down to the water's edge. They had been gathering groundnuts and seemed distressingly nonchalant given what the pilgrims had been led to believe. Standish asked why they had left the ship without anyone on guard. Like men senseless of their own misery, they replied that they had no fear of the Indians. In fact, many of them were living with the Massachusetts in their wigwams. If this was indeed the case, then why was Standish about to launch an attack? Had Pratt simply told the pilgrims what they wanted to hear? Standish was not about to allow anything, not even evidence that all was peace at Wissagusset, to dissuade him from his plan. He marched to the fort and demanded to speak to whoever was in charge. Once he'd done his best to quell the Indians' suspicions, he explained, he was going to kill as many of them as he could. With the completion of the mission, the settlers could either return with him to Plymouth or take the Swan up to Maine. Standish had even brought along some corn to sustain them during their voyage east. It was their hunger, not their fear of the Indians, that was the chief concern of Weston's men. It was not surprising, then, that they quickly embraced Standish's plan, since it meant they would soon have something to eat. Swearing all to secrecy, the captain instructed them to tell those who were living outside the settlement to return as soon as possible to the safety of the fort. Unfortunately, the weather had deteriorated, and the rain and wind prompted several of the English to remain in the warmth of the Indians' wigwams. In the meantime, a warrior approached the fort under the pretense of trading furs with Standish. The fiery military officer tried to appear welcoming and calm, but it was clear to the Indian that Standish was up to no good. Once back among his friends, he reported that he saw by his eyes that the captain was angry in his heart. This prompted the Massachusetts Panisse Pexuat to approach Habermock. He told the Poconocket warrior that he knew exactly what Standish was up to and that he and Witoamat were afraid of him. "Let him begin when he dare," he told Habermock. "He shall not take us unawares." Later that day, both Pexuat and Witoamat brashly walked up to Standish. Pexuat was a tall man, and he made a point of looking disdainfully down on the Pilgrim military officer. "You are a great captain," he said, "yet you are but a little man. Though I be no sachem, yet I am of great strength and courage." For his part, Witoamat continued to whet and sharpen the same knife he had so ostentatiously flourished in Standish's presence several weeks before at Manomet. On the knife's handle was the carved outline of a woman's face. "I have another at home," he told Standish, "wherewith I have killed both French and English, and that has a man's face on it. By and by these two must marry." "These things the captain observed," Winslow wrote, "yet bore with patience for the present." The next day, Standish lured both Witoamat and Pexuat into one of the settlement's houses for a meal. In addition to corn, he had brought along some pork. The two Massachusetts Panisses were wary of the Plymouth captain, but they were also very hungry, and, as Standish had anticipated, pork was a delicacy that the Indians found almost impossible to resist. Witoamat and Pexuat were accompanied by Witoamat's brother and a friend, along with several women. Besides Standish, there were three other pilgrims and Habermock in the room. Once they had all sat down and begun to eat, the captain signaled for the door to be shut. He turned to Pexuat and grabbed the knife from the string around the Panisse's neck. Before the Indian had a chance to respond, Standish had begun stabbing him with his own weapon. The point was needle sharp, and Pexuat's chest was soon riddled with blood-spurting wounds. As Standish and Pexuat struggled, the other pilgrims assaulted Witoamat and his companion. "It is incredible," Winslow wrote, "how many wounds these two Panisses received before they died, not making any fearful noise, but catching at their weapons and striving to the last." All the while, Habermock stood by and watched. Soon the three Indians were dead, and Witoamat's teenage brother had been taken captive. A smile broke out across Habermock's face, and he said, "Yesterday, Pexuat, bragging of his own strength and stature, said, 'Though you were a great captain, yet you were but a little man. Today I see you are big enough to lay him on the ground.'" But the killing had just begun. Witoamat's brother was quickly hanged. There was another company of pilgrims elsewhere in the settlement, and Standish sent word to them to kill any Indians who happened to be with him. As a result, two more were put to death. In the meantime, Standish and his cohorts found another Indian and killed him. With Habermock and some of Weston's men in tow, Standish headed out in search of more Indians. They soon came across Sachem Abtakiest and a group of Massachusetts warriors. Situated between the English and the Indians was a rise of land that would afford a strategic advantage, and both groups began to run for it. Standish reached it first, and the Indians quickly scattered along the edge of the nearby forest, each man hiding behind a tree. Arrows were soon whizzing through the brisk afternoon air, most of them aimed at Standish and Habermock. Being a Panisse, and therefore supposedly invulnerable, Habermock looked scornfully at the Indians behind the trees. Throwing off his coat, he began to chase after them, and most of them fled so quickly that none of the English could keep up with them. There was a powwow who stood his ground and aimed an arrow at Standish. They later learned that he had been one of the original instigators of the plot against them. The captain and another Englishman fired simultaneously at the powwow, and the bullets broke his arm. With that, the remaining Indians, which included Sachem Abtakiest, ran for the shelter of a nearby swamp where they paused to hurl taunts and expletives at the Plymouth captain. Standish challenged the sachem to fight him man to man, but after a final exchange of insults, Abtakiast and the others disappeared into the swamp. Several women had been captured during the scuffle with Pexuat and Wituamat. Now that the killing spree had finally come to an end, Standish decided to release the women, even though he knew there were at least three of Weston's men still living with the Indians. If he had kept these women as hostages, Standish could easily have bargained for the Englishmen's lives. But killing Indians, not saving lives, appears to have been the captain's chief priority at Wessagusset, and all three Englishmen were later executed. Now that Standish's terrifying whirlwind of violence had come to an apparent end, the vast majority of the Wessagusset survivors decided to sail for Monhegan. The pilgrims waited until the Swan had cleared Massachusetts Bay, then turned their shallops south for Plymouth with the head of Wituamat wrapped in a piece of white linen. Standish arrived at Plymouth to a hero's welcome. After being received with joy, the captain and his men marched up to the newly completed fort, where Wituamat's head was planted on a pole on the fort's roof. As it turned out, the fort contained its first prisoner, an Indian who had been sent in pursuit of Phineas Pratt. Unable to find Pratt, who had saved his own life by becoming so hopelessly lost, the Indian had continued past Plymouth to Manomet, then backtracked to the English settlement in hopes of obtaining some information about the pilgrims. By this time, Standish had already departed for Wessagusset, and suspicious of the Indian's motives, Bradford had thrown him in irons until the captain's return. The Indian was released from his shackles and brought out for examination. After looking piteously on the head of Wituamat, the captive confessed everything. The plot had not originally been Sachem Abtakiast's idea. There were five, Wituamat, Pexuat, and three powwows, including the one Standish had injured at Wessagusset, who had convinced their sachem to launch an attack against the pilgrims. Bradford released the prisoner on the condition that he carry a message to Abtakiast. If the sachem dared to continue in the like courses, Bradford vowed, he would never suffer him or his to rest in peace till he had utterly consumed them. It took many days for the pilgrims to receive an answer. Finally, a Massachusetts woman appeared at Plymouth with Abtakiast's response. She explained that her sachem was eager to make peace with the pilgrims, but none of his men were willing to approach the settlement. Ever since the massacre at Wessagusset, Abtakiast had kept on the move, fearful that Standish might return and take further vengeance on him. The Massachusetts were not the only Indians in the region to have taken flight into the wilderness. All throughout Cape Cod, from Manomet to Nauset to Pamet, the native inhabitants had fled in panic, convinced that Standish and his thugs were about to descend on their villages and kill every Indian in sight. This sudden and unexpected execution, Edward Winslow wrote, hath so terrified and amazed them, as in like manner they forsook their houses, running to and fro like men distracted, living in swamps and other desert places, and so brought manifold diseases amongst themselves, whereof very many are dead. Huddled in swamps and on remote islands, fearful that to venture back to their villages meant certain death, Indians throughout the region were unable to plant the crops on which their lives depended. By summer, they had begun to die at a startling rate. Certainly, it is strange to hear how many of late have, and still daily, die amongst them, Winslow wrote. Just about every notable sachem on the Cape died in the months ahead, including Canacom at Manomet, Aspinet at Nauset, and the personable, courteous, and fair-conditioned Iano at Cummaquid. Word reached Plymouth that before he died, the handsome young sachem had, in the midst of these distractions, said the God of the English was offended with them and would destroy them in his anger. One village decided to send some gifts to the pilgrims in hopes of establishing peace, but the Indians' canoe capsized almost within sight of the plantation, and three of them drowned. Since that incident, not a single Indian from Cape Cod had dared to approach the settlement. Among the Massachusetts, the Pilgrims had earned a new name, Wotoquenunj, Cutthroats. Standish's raid had irreparably damaged the human ecology of the region. Not only had the Pilgrims proved unexpectedly violent and vindictive, but Massasoit had betrayed his former confederates. By siding with the Pilgrims against the Indians of Massachusetts and Cape Cod, the Poconoket sachem had initiated a new and terrifying era in New England. It was no longer a question of Indian versus English. It was now possible for alliances and feuds to reach across racial lines in a confusing amalgam of cultures. It took some time before a new equilibrium came to the region. In the immediate aftermath of the Wessagusset raid, the Pilgrims were astonished to discover that they had at least temporarily ruined their ability to trade with the Indians. "We have been much damaged in our trade," Bradford wrote to the merchant adventurers, "for there where we had the most skins, the Indians are run away from their habitations and set no corn, so as we can by no means as yet come to speak with them." Without furs as a potential source of income, the Pilgrims looked to cod fishing, with the usual disastrous results. The people who had been helped by the attack were the Poconokets. With the death of the most influential sachems on Cape Cod, a huge power vacuum had been created in the region. Prior to Wessagusset, Aspinet, sachem of the Nossets, had commanded more warriors than Massasoit. But now Aspinet was dead, and his people had fled in panic. Over the next few years, Massasoit established the Indian nation we now refer to as the Wampanoag, an entity that may not even have existed before this crucial watershed. It was exactly the scenario Squanto had envisioned for himself the year before, but it had been Massasoit who had pulled it off. Just a few words, delivered from what had almost been his deathbed, had unleashed a chain of events that had completely reinvented the region in his own image. The English had served him well. The Pilgrims knew that there were those back in England who would criticize them for launching what was in essence an unprovoked attack on Sachem, Abtakiast, and the Massachusetts. In the months ahead, Edward Winslow wrote, "Good News from New England." As the title suggests, Winslow's account puts the Wessagusset raid in the best possible light. The Pilgrims, Winslow points out, had been operating in a climate of intense fear since learning about the massacres in Virginia the previous spring. Given the dramatic and apparently irrefutable nature of Massasoit's disclosure of the plot against them, there was little else they could have been expected to do. There was one man, however, who refused to forgive the Pilgrims for the killing of those poor Indians. When he heard about the incident back in Leiden, Pastor John Robinson sent Governor Bradford a letter. "Oh, how happy a thing had it been," he wrote, "if you had converted some before you had killed any. Besides, where blood is once begun to be shed, it is seldom staunched for a long time after. You say they deserved it. I grant it. But upon what provocations and invitements by those heathenish Christians at Wessagusset?" The real problem, as far as Robinson saw it, was Bradford's willingness to trust Standish, a man the minister had come to know when he was in Leiden. The captain lacked that tenderness of the life of man made after God's image, which is meat, Robinson wrote, and the orgiastic violence of the assault was contrary to the approved rule, the punishment to a few and the fear to many. Robinson concluded his letter to Bradford with words that proved ominously prophetic given the ultimate course of New England's history. "It is a thing more glorious in men's eyes than pleasing in God's or convenient for Christians to be a terror to poor barbarous people. And indeed I am afraid lest, by these occasions, others should be drawn to affect a kind of ruffling course in the world." That summer, the supply ship Anne arrived with 60 passengers, including the widow, Alice Southworth. The South